Conclusion: The Awakening of the U.S. Navy. The decade of the 1830s, under Andrew Jackson's presidency, is an important era in the evolution of the U.S. Navy. Evolving navies do not grow at a consistent rate. They advance, stagnate, and sometimes regress in response to a variety of external and internal factors. Externally, key factors affecting a navy's growth include alliances, conventional and unconventional threats, commercial opportunities, and the availability of rich resources. Internally or domestically, the factors may include the influence of politicians and policymakers, the availability of resources and technologies, the economic ability to build ships or invest in other aspects of a navy, and the tenor of the naval culture, which either fosters new ideas and visions or suppresses them in favor of more conservative values and traditions. All these factors were evident in the first five-decade prelude to Jackson's administration, leading to a period of advancement for the Navy during his terms in office. From 1815 to 1829, the U.S. Navy tested its strength and logistical ability in international maritime security by deploying its first permanent squadrons to distant stations. The Navy also tested the use of steam power on one ship, but found that it lacked the necessary infrastructure to ensure efficiency or expansion across the fleet. Except for the construction of ships of the line, the fleet remained what it had been for several decades. But under Jackson, in the 1830s, the Navy evolved physically, intellectually, and socially, experiencing a multifaceted growth spurt that significantly impacted its shape and character well into the late 19th century. During Jackson's presidency, the fleet's size remained constant, but its overall capability improved. The years-long deployments to distant stations after the War of 1812 had put physical strain on the ships. When Jackson took office, he directed a much-needed reinvestment in the Navy's ships by decommissioning some, repairing others, and building new platforms. In 1831, naval construction spiked as the United States replaced several older and obsolescent ships. Construction of the first dry docks at naval stations also improved the capabilities of the fleet. These dry docks gave the Navy a tool previously afforded only to larger, more mature navies, and quietly announced to the world that the Navy was preparing for the enhanced role in global affairs. During Jackson's tenure, commercial steamships also proliferated, encouraging the transition of steam technology from commercial craft to Navy ships. By the end of the decade, the Navy was building its own steam-propelled frigates. The 1830s was also a reflective period for officers, who collectively evolved intellectually. Influential officers like Matthew C. Perry fostered junior officers' thinking about naval issues. Establishment of the Naval Lyceum offered junior officers a forum in which to consider and discuss personnel challenges, force structures, strategies, and education. For the first time, many wrote in public forums such as the Lyceum's Naval Magazine or other periodicals. Although the junior officers often wrote under pseudonyms to avoid the appearance of open disrespect, they, nonetheless, challenged the conventional thinking of their senior officers. Those senior officers sometimes responded in kind, thus stimulating a vigorous debate for the first time in the Navy's history. During this period of technological advancements, naval officers began to recognize the inadequacy of their on-the-job education in steamship and navigation. Naval officers argued for a school to ensure that all new midshipmen learn the standardized science, technology, engineering, and mathematics required to operate and command the expected steam-powered Navy. They nourished the debate on naval education that led to the creation of the Naval Academy. The Navy also assumed greater responsibilities in the world in response to the nation's expanding commercial interests. The Navy had made its initial foray into commerce protection in the West Indies and the Mediterranean around the beginning of the 19th century. Having suppressed the Barbary States in the First and Second Barbary Wars, as well as the pirates of the West Indies, the Navy turned its attention to other areas of the globe. new treaties under Jackson meant more trade routes for American merchant ships, which required greater protection by the Navy. This geographical expansion of patrols meant the Navy increasingly encountered other navies, nations, and cultures. As the 1830s progressed, the Navy was becoming more exploratory and learning about the world. This development was evident at the Naval Lyceum as well as in the fleet itself. Officers collected items from the ancient sites in Greece, native tribes of the Pacific Islands, ancient civilizations of South America, and elsewhere. Officers mailed these artifacts with narratives to the Lyceum, which also served as a museum. Contacts with other navies resulted in meetings and lectures at the Lyceum. A younger, less involved navy would have required a great deal of time and attention from its commander-in-chief and other leaders. The quickly growing navy that Jackson inherited, however, had only two primary needs from his perspective. First, accountability for its actions, and second, guidance on what it ought to do. Jackson's approach to leadership coincided with the Navy's needs, and thus, his role for the Navy was a paternal one. Just as Jackson expected fiscal accountability from the Navy itself, he and senior officers demanded professional accountability from its officers and sailors, demonstrated through adherence to regulations and the good order and discipline of naval personnel. Courts-martial offer the individuals accountability necessary to discipline the adolescent officer corps. Proceedings reveal that both officers and sailors were expected to hold to high standards of behavior, and that some of them did not. Whereas a sailor's punishment, which might be as severe as a whipping, was administered immediately and then was over, an officer could be discharged and lose a lifetime of pay and prestige. Jackson took direct action in more naval courts-martial than any president from John Adams to James Buchanan, 1798 to 1860. Jackson officially commented on one quarter of the courts-martial that passed his desk. In one third of the cases he reviewed, he either overturned the result or granted remission of the punishment recommended by the court-martial board, thereby establishing himself as a firm but compassionate father figure. Jackson also met the growing Navy's need for guidance and direction. Under his leadership, for the first time, the United States developed a global strategy to respond to crisis, act as a deterrent, and protect growing American commerce. The nation was still a third-rate global power, but its quickly expanding economy and merchant fleet needed greater protection. The U.S. fleet numbered only a few dozen ships, but those ships were an important sign to both non-state actors and nation-states that the country intended to keep a forward presence. Although Jackson had been an Army general, he recognized the importance of the global maritime environment. His addresses and messages to Congress make clear his belief that America's place in the world was dependent on shipping, and that threats posed to that shipping could only be answered by a sufficiently sized navy. He developed a national maritime strategy, which he expressed both in words, his limited statements, and indeed the fleet's operational patterns. He promoted economic trade agreements with both traditional and new partners to establish favorable conditions for American merchant ships. He maintained and expanded the squadron system at key geographical locations to protect those ships and ensure security deterrence to potential predators. Finally, he ordered punitive strikes, though only if necessary and as a last resort. He also used the Navy in a supportive role along the coastline of Florida during the Second Seminole War and in riverine operations. Overall, when it came to the high seas, Jackson exercised the judicious use of force. Jackson's annual messages to Congress, his inaugural addresses, and his farewell address revealed his thoughts on the purpose of a Navy, the pragmatic limitations of the Navy at the time, and its opportunity for growth and defense of the nation and its interests overseas. His executive decisions on diversifying the force structure, incorporating new technologies, expanding global operations in support of commerce, and directing joint Army-Navy activities in the Second Seminole War prove that he was as capable a navalist as the best of his predecessors. Jackson set a clear agenda for the Navy that continued with his successors. Jackson had a clear understanding of the Navy as a necessary arm of the nation's foreign policy and commercial expansion, and of how to project its limited power in the pre-steam era. He had little experience with the Navy before he became president, but he learned quickly and thoroughly. Threats on the high seas and in distant ports underscored the crucial role of the Navy in protecting and promoting his country's interests. Having found in Jackson a necessary paternal figure, the Navy needed a pure ideal that transcended politics, justified its existence, and gave it a cause. In the antebellum era, the strongest national rallying cry was Manifest Destiny, the desire and expectation that America's boundaries would push west to the Pacific Ocean, regardless of what or who lay in its path. Although the term itself was not formally coined until 1845, the impact of the concept was evident during the two prior decades. One notable example of this impact is Jackson's removal of tribes from their ancestral territories as Americans pushed further south and west. Manifest Destiny signaled that a virtuous people were entitled to the land and could seize it by any means necessary. The Army, either through its battles with Indians or in the war with Mexico, was critical in helping the United States actualize Manifest Destiny. The Navy's guiding principle, however, was different. The Navy was governed by a broader and unlimited concept, that of maritime destiny. Maritime destiny was the belief that America's future lay on the oceans, not merely in its lands. The term, which first appeared in 1834 in Miriam Coffin by Joseph Hart, predates Manifest Destiny by more than a decade. Its initial appearance in a work of fiction should not diminish its importance or value. On the contrary, its advent suggests the fundamental nature of maritime destiny. Hart's story focused on the Nantucket whaling industry, an enterprise that had been under the protection of the Pacific Squadron since 1870. Hart was part of a generation of early American literary figures who chose the sea as the outlet of their expression. These writers recognized and captured the national spirit of expectancy and hope. That spirit saw U.S. expansion to the Pacific as inevitable, but also expected the United States to play a greater role in the world, a role that could be realized only on the sea. A nation that relies heavily on shipborne trade understands the importance of the sea and is familiar with the tension between the risks and rewards of navigating an unforgiving ocean. The United States, which had relied on shipborne trade since long before its own founding, was no exception. Americans, particularly New Englanders, had also experienced threats by other nations and by pirates. Unsurprisingly, then, the United States could appreciate the need for a Navy to protect the wealth that drove her economy and was willing to support it. Unlike the landlocked Army, the Navy was an instrument of the spread of American commerce and, correspondingly, American ideals to foreign shores. It is not possible to quantify whether maritime destiny was an instrument of naval and national policy, or was a perspective that developed and drew the Navy behind it. However, the Navy's operations, the President's vision, and the discourse among officers and literary figures indicate that, by the close of the 1830s, the young Navy had experienced meaningful growth and, in a sense, become self-aware. When Jackson assumed the presidency in 1829, the United States was a third-rate power with a Navy to match. When he left office in 1837, the Navy had professionalized and modernized, grown in capabilities and prestige, broadened its physical and intellectual horizons, and found its purpose. As Tocqueville observed earlier that decade, America was born to rule the seas. At the close of the 1830s, the Navy was not quite ready to assume that mantle, but it had made strides forward and was acquiring the knowledge and wisdom that would later bring fulfillment of this destiny on wide seas.